He is a little bit more. And now, how was his?
The following program is pre-recorded. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to my UFO show. New Mexico, late 40s and early 50s. The scene of death and destruction. No, not of humans, but of extraterrestrials.
Oh, my God. It's a body.
Did we ever decide how many ETs we actually shot and killed?
No. And probably an explanation on that. A UFO crashed in Aztec, New Mexico, and the government immediately came in, cordoned off the area, wouldn't let anybody in, and they reported that there were 16 dead aliens on it. What the remote viewers found was that not all of those aliens were dead. Most of them were, but not all. And that the government took the live ones back, and that the plan was to make them allies and, you know, to get them on our side because the Cold War was just starting, the Second World War was just over, everybody was afraid of the bomb and all that. And that when they started trying to communicate with them, they found out that the language the ETs had was part telepathic, and that the ETs, in trying to communicate with them, were getting into their minds, and that what they wanted more than anything else was to get their ship back and leave. And, of course, the ship, I mean, you know, looked like it had been left in Harlem overnight or over the weekend or something. I mean, that thing was stripped. They weren't getting that thing back. And so they were going to just imprison them, and they realized that because of the telepathic ability, they could get free by simply controlling the minds of the guards. They didn't know what to do with them. They couldn't handle them, and the ETs just didn't want to be here. And so with the mentality of the war that was just over and the new war, you know, the Cold War coming, and the commanders or those who were in charge in the government of this project realized that the only way to handle this situation was to kill the ETs, and so they executed those that were left. That's what our remote viewers
found. This seems incredible. I mean, do you have any idea who in the government ordered the execution?
Yes, I do. My time in the government and in, you know, in the classified areas of the government, yes, I absolutely do. Well, they wanted to make them allies. They wanted to be...
Well, I know, but, I mean, you know, you kill extraterrestrial beings from another place. It just seems to be counterproductive.
Well, it does to me, too. And I don't think that would happen these days. If that same situation happened, I don't think that would even be a consideration. I think they would find out how to do things.
And we wonder why these ETs just don't land and say, "Hi, we're here." It's too dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
It's
there are certain places on our Earth that we don't go.
It's not a new analogy, but, you know, missionaries land on an island full of cannibals, and before you know it, they're lunch.
That's right. That's right. No, I don't blame them for not, you know, becoming, you know, landing on the White House lawn and becoming public. And on the White House lawn, they get shot anyway.
That was well-known remote viewer Lynn Buchanan talking about the Aztec UFO crash of 1948. He was tasked by the symposium at Aztec to get some remote viewers together, assemble them, and actually see if they could target the Aztec crash, and they did. First, he had 11 for last year and 7 this year. And we have the rest of our interview with Lynn Buchanan coming up here in a minute as we talk about Aztec. Later on, we will move on and expand the scope of this show as we talk about New Mexico and UFO crashes in general. And, of course, you can't do that without talking about Roswell. And they have their 64th annual anniversary coming up here pretty soon. It's hard to believe it's been that far away, that long ago. Now, in addition to that, we have some presidential remarks about the Roswell crash that I think you'll find interesting, and a few other things. So please stay tuned to the show. First of all, we need to address Aztec. There's been a lot of flap. I'm getting a lot of heat, I guess, from the people who just don't want to believe Aztec happened. And in fact, many of them have really kind of attacked me over the last couple of weeks when we talk about this. But the fact is that the evidence is really beginning to grow that Aztec did happen. As you know, we have the FBI memo from Guy Hoddle, the FBI agent in charge of the District of Columbia office, in the early 50s, talking about his report that he received from a witness, and that was the fact that there were three UFO crashes and ETs were killed. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about this memo, and we have, I guess, just about every angle you want to cover on this at UFOshows2go.com. You want to go up there. It's up in the right-hand corner. Listen to that show. It's about 29 minutes long. But it's we examine all of the facts and whether or not it was a fraud, whether it was the real case or whatever, and let you make up your own mind. That's at UFOshows2go.com. Now, Victor Martinez, who has a huge list of UFO scientists, or maybe I should say it this way, scientists and UFO enthusiasts. Yeah, that's probably a better way to say it. He has a couple of thousand people on that list. And he was quite impressed with the idea that Lynn Buchanan, as a remote viewer, was able to target this Aztec crash. Now, he went to his source, Anonymous 3, and he's famous for the Serpo memos. Remember the Serpo story? Whether we had an alien transfer, we took some ETs here and sent some of our astronauts to another planet. Well, Anonymous 3, who peddles the Serpo story, told Victor he had never heard about this crash, and he says it's not in the book. Now, what he's talking about is a secret book. I believe it's called the Yellow Book, in which supposedly all of the ET crashes and landings and contacts are laid out. It's top secret, so not many people have seen it. So it's hard to, judge the veracity of it, whether it's true or not. Now, we're going to go ahead and play the rest of this interview with Lynn Buchanan. And if you'd like to hear the entire interview, all you have to do is just go to our website, jerrypippin.com, and you can enter it in the search engine, Lynn Buchanan, or you can actually, it's on the highlights window right now, but doesn't stay there forever. But you can always go to our paranormal index, a little button up at the top says Parazone, and we have Lynn and all of his interviews. So let's go ahead and listen to the rest of the interview with Lynn Buchanan. As you know, we're talking with Lynn Buchanan, noted controlled remote viewer. And Lynn, in the first part of the show, we talked a little bit about Aztec and whether or not the crash really happened, and you assumed that it did because their cadre of remote viewers all seemed to validate that a crash happened. Also, many of them reported an execution of ETs, which puzzles me. I can't imagine anybody ordering something like that. I mean, surely somebody faced some consequences. I don't see any record of it.
Well, yeah, but, a lot of stupid mistakes are made by rulers and those in charge, and there were consequences of it. One, we didn't get them as allies. I just wonder where the world would be right now if we had.
Excellent point you make there, Lynn. I imagine this is not the only time that if we knew all the history and all the secrets were uncovered, that we've had brilliant opportunities and blown them.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And there are plenty of other times, I think, when we didn't blow it, where we've made some good decisions. And, you know, history is full of mistakes and also full of good decisions. So, you know, that wasn't the only crash that's ever happened, and that wasn't the only contact that's ever been made.
Lynn, before you get off here, I want to discuss a little bit about your company and you yourself about controlled remote viewing. Do you do workshops for the public as well as companies?
Yeah, in fact, most of the classes we teach are for the public. If you look on our website, there's a schedule of classes that we give, and then the ones for like corporations, they don't want anybody knowing that, first of all, they're using remote viewing, and second, they don't want to know, they don't want anyone to know who the remote viewers are, and so those never make it onto our training calendar. But, yeah, most of the classes that we teach are to the general public. Now that this is in the civilian arena, its applications are just blossoming. I mean, you know, in the military, it was used for military applications. Out in the public, we find that information is valuable no matter to whom. Telling an archaeologist, dig here, don't dig there, saves the archaeologist, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Telling a business, go with plan B rather than plan A, saves the company. Finding missing persons, doing drug interdiction, all of this is these applications are just phenomenal. We have found that under the right circumstances, a doctor using this can pick up illnesses long before even his finest equipment can pick it up. And so, you know, it saves not only the doctor in doing his work, but also the patient.
Amazing. I hadn't thought of the medical ramifications of controlled remote viewing. One thing that really puzzles me about it, but I guess it's true, is there's not any difference between time and distance. I mean, you can go forward in time or backwards, forward in distance or backwards. I mean, You told me about that in one broadcast a little bit earlier.
Yeah, in CRV, in controlled remote viewing, I don't know about the other remote viewings out there, but in controlled remote viewing, there's absolutely no difference in protocol between saying move forward 10 feet and move forward 10 years.
I'm sure there are remote viewers, maybe you've done it, go back in history and check out historic events to see if they really happened.
Oh, yeah, we do a lot of training with that, yeah. And we also have had a lot of authors come in who like to write historical works, and we've had some scientists come in as well who, you know, are archaeologists and scientists and paleontologists and all that. One of the things that is an excellent example. We had an archaeologist come in one time. He asked the question, why? And that was all he asked. And so we found a lot of information, but the summary wound up because they didn't have money. And
you mean the society didn't have money? They didn't use money?
Yeah, and he sort of blew it off, but he came back about 2 years later and he said, what did you mean by they didn't have money? And I said, well, I didn't mean they were broke. I meant that they didn't have the concept of money. Come to find out, the question why was, why did the Aztec cities, the Mayan cities, just empty out overnight? And the reason was because they didn't have the concept of money, and so the way they supported the government was just like with the National Guard. People from farms and all that would have to spend their 2 weeks out of the year at these centers serving the government, building roads and all this other stuff. And and so when the government fell, basically, the people who were there for their 2 weeks went home. Nobody else had been told to come because the government just wasn't, you know, keeping any of its schedules or anything. And so nobody else was told to come, and so nobody came. And as a result, the what they have been thinking were cities, but which were really not, those cities emptied out at night as the farmers went home. The next day, nobody came back. And this archaeologist said that this explains everything that they have just not had a an answer to for all these years.
In other words, no one was using the facility.
Yeah, that's right. They were all back at their farms.
Another thing about control remote viewing, have you or your group, or do you know of people who came across an impending disaster, either natural or man-made? You try to warn people and nobody pays attention, or maybe they do.
Well, some of them pay attention. We see disasters coming, but it's one of those things of...
Maybe you have to be focused on it.
Well, it's not that. It's not hard to see the impending disasters and the impending good things that happen as well. The whole problem is having the contacts with the people who can do something about it. And then, you know, even if you get the news to the people who can do something about it, are they going to be macho enough to stand up and say, hey, this is on the way and we know this is going to happen and so let's do something about it? And you know, like the Japanese earthquake, who would you tell about it so that they would take the action required to save the plants, save, you know, pull the rods out of the plants before the earthquake happened and all that? I know at 9/11, I was supposed to be in Lower Manhattan on 9/11, and on the 9th, my wife and I were just pacing back and forth on the patio out here. We knew that something bad was going to happen. And the next day, five planes broke down that I got on going to New York. And I got there like a day late. And I got there early in the morning of 9/11. And, you know, I was like four blocks from the buildings when they came down. And, I mean, who could you have told about that that would have prevented it? That would have listened. And so, you know, these things like this, you can prepare for it yourself with the information. But getting that information to someone who will actually take the gumption to do something about it, that's the hard
thing. You started this remote viewing while you were in the military, so you've had lots of military contacts over the years. And I remember in one broadcast you told me there was a major event that you knew ahead of time, and you didn't tell anybody. And I said, why didn't you? And you said, nobody asked.
True. Us. When the helicopters came down in the desert when they were trying the hostage rescue in Lebanon, the helicopters crashed because there was sand in the motors, and our report got to the president 10 minutes before the electronic report did. And of course, by that time, there was nothing that could be done about it. But you know, had they tasked us with the success of that mission, we could have prevented some stuff.
What do you think about the military? They seem to say they're not using remote viewing, but you think they still are? Not just not telling us?
Well, they're not telling me. I'm retired.
Yeah.
And My answer to that question is always, I hope so, because they would be stupid not to.
So you are really convinced that kind of remote viewing has been very successful, and your service to the country was successful.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The thing about this government would be stupid not to also raises the question of, does the government ever do anything stupid? And so, you know, when people ask me, I say, I hope so, but I really don't.
Lynn, earlier you mentioned 9/11, and Janet Saylor, who covered the Aztec conference for me, said basically that you think Bin Laden's still alive.
Yeah, well, we've known his location and all that. They just don't want
Someday we're going to have to get you to focus in on 9/11. I'd love to know what remote viewing really shows. Our time's almost up, Lynn. You got anything else you want to say?
Well, if anybody's interested in finding out more about it, they have the website there. I hate people who come on the radio and hawk their books, but, well, there's a lot of information about controlled remote viewing and what we did in the military in a book I wrote called The Seventh Sense. And you can get that through Amazon, or it's put out by Simon & Schuster. And
that's a good publisher.
A lot of information, and it also has exercises that will teach you how to develop a line of information between your conscious and subconscious mind. So it's a good book to have, and it's one of the very few books out there that actually teaches you something rather than just telling you something.
Lynn Buchanan, always a pleasure having you on. You know, you lead an interesting life. We need to stay in contact more.
Well, we have the International Remote Viewing Association's annual conference coming up in Las Vegas in June. And I think it's June 17th through 19th. And that is open to the public. We have a lot of speakers, a lot of the ex-military people, a lot of the researchers. And this is absolutely not a voodoo and woo-woo type situation. This is the science of controlled remote viewing and the science of remote viewing itself. And so it winds up being a real eye-opener for a lot of people who are interested in this, but just haven't known where to get into it.
I'm sure a lot of people would like to know more information about that conference out in Las Vegas.
Yeah, they have a website. It's IRVA, International Remote Viewers Association, irvaconference.org.
Now, your group, your cadre of remote viewers that work with you closely, Lynn, they're not just around Arizona and New Mexico. I mean, they're around the world, right?
Oh, yeah. Since this came out from the military arena into the civilian arena, we have taught viewers from just about every country you can imagine. And, you know, we were not the only country who had, quote, I hate this term, psychic spies. Almost every country in the world has had mental spying for decades and decades now, and some of them fairly successful. Ours wound up having the highest dependability rate simply because we did not depend on natural talent. We depended on a scientific method that could be taught to any soldier, and therefore any person.
Lynn, thank you very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Who knows? Maybe we'll see you in Las Vegas in June.
Good.
Fascinating show. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X, comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The ebook of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. Okay, I want to talk to you about Roswell for a little bit, if it's okay. Basically, when we talk about New Mexico and UFO crashes, you have to talk about Roswell. And they're getting ready for their 64th annual observation of that UFO crash. They have a big festival there every year. Now, some new tape is arriving in our door box, in our mailbox. And basically, it's from Grant Cameron, and he found a very interesting comment or two about Roswell by none other than President Bill Clinton. Now, I thought, in fairness, we need to play President Bill Clinton's earlier comment about Roswell, and Grant Cameron found that one as well. So, listen to these two comments, and then I want to talk about Roswell for a minute, okay?
I got a letter from 13-year-old Ryan from Belfast. Now, Ryan, if you're out in the crowd tonight, here's the answer to your question. No. As far as I know, an alien spacecraft did not crash in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And Ryan, if the United States Air Force did recover alien bodies, they didn't tell me about it either, and I want to know.
Well, that was the first soundbite, President Clinton in Belfast, Ireland, and a lot of people thought that was a hidden message to the Air Force that they should fess up to Clinton. However, later, after his presidency, President Bill Clinton made an appearance on a talk show in Hong Kong in which he was a little more definite. He was almost as definite as Peter Jennings. The late Peter Jennings was in his UFO special when Peter Jennings said Roswell was a myth. Listen and make your own mind up.
I've always wanted to ask this question, and I'm going to use my position to ask it quickly. When I was at your library, that's not that bad, don't worry. When I was at your library opening, I was standing in your replica office, Oval Office. It's an incredibly powerful feeling. I've never been to the White House. I'm not a Republican. But I looked at your desk, and I was wondering, from president to president, whether you'd pass a list along of secrets that only you and a couple of President Bush Sr., President Bush, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford know, like, where's Jimmy Hoffa? Or what really happened at Roswell. So without giving away any state secrets, is there something we can all look forward to in the future to read about that you know that we don't know that will really make the National Enquirer required reading?
I don't know if you all remember this, but there was actually, when I was president in my second term, there was an anniversary observance of Roswell. You remember that? Mm-hmm. People came to Roswell, New Mexico from all over the world. And there's also a site in Nevada where people were convinced that the government had buried a UFO and perhaps an alien deep underground because we wouldn't allow anybody to go there. And I can say now, because it's now been released into the public domain, I had so many people in my own administration were convinced that Roswell was a fraud, but this place in Nevada was really serious. There was an alien artifact there. So I actually sent somebody there to figure it out. And it was actually just a secret defense installation, alas, and doing boring work that we just didn't want anybody else to see. So I can't think of that. I give you a serious thing, though. I spent a lot of, in 2000, I was able to participate with Tony Blair and representatives of the French, German, Japanese, and Canadian governments in announcing that we had succeeded in sequencing the human genome. And perhaps some of you have investments in all these biotech companies, and now you know we cloned Dolly the sheep, and now apparently they may have cloned a dog, and we were all talking about this. My own view is that, assuming we don't do something stupid like burn ourselves up with global warming or blow ourselves up with a military conflict we could just as easily avoid, I think a lot of these biotechnology issues will be the dominant sort of intellectual and ethical challenges of the lives of those of you who are 10, 20, 30 years younger than I am. Because I think that we are going to be able to save people's lives that, you know, my generation couldn't be saved. And we are going to come up against the limits of our own mortality in a way we never could before. And a lot of the things that happen, good and bad, will be stranger than anything ever written in science fiction. But I don't know the answers. Which is one reason I would like to live to be 100, just to see what happens. The Roswell thing, I think, really was an illusion. I don't think it happened. I mean, I think there are rational explanations that I have succeeded. And I did attempt to find out if there were any secret government documents that reveal things. And if there were, they were concealed from me, too. I wouldn't be the first president that underlings have lied to or that career bureaucrats have waited out. But there may be some career person sitting around somewhere hiding these dark secrets, even from elected presidents. But if so, they successfully eluded me. And I'm almost embarrassed to tell you I did try to find out. I do believe, by the way, I'll be just as one more flaky. You can even also be flaky when you're out of office. I believe that now that we know there are not hundreds, not millions, but billions of other solar systems out there, thanks to the Hubble telescope and what we know about black holes in the universe and all of that, the dimensions of physics are such that I would be quite surprised if in the lifetime of people that are no older than 30 here, we don't discover some form of life in another universe. It's pretty clear that there was something approaching elemental life on Mars at one time in the past, based on what we've already discovered there. So I say that only to say this. I hope all of you, wherever you live, will continue to support space exploration. Whether manned or unmanned is not so important, but we have to keep doing that. And I'm afraid that there will be a waning interest in it in the future. I think it's a great mistake. I think we should continue to explore the boundaries of our existence, both into the earth and beyond the skies. When I was president, we discovered in the bottom of the Amazon River, we were just a small part of this, but two previously undiscovered forms of marine life so deep in the Amazon that they had never been found in all the efforts of marine biologists. So I think there are lots of interesting discoveries, biological, on Earth, and other discoveries in the heavens that those of you who are younger will get to see unfold. You'll have all kind of problems with them, but on balance, it'll be a plus. And it'll make life much more interesting.
I'd like to thank UFO presidential historian Grant Cameron for coming up with the soundbite. And there you have it. The president, President Clinton, I normally agree with him on most things, but I do think that if you had a court trial, you could prove circumstantially that a UFO did land at Roswell. Lots of people believe it, and lots of interesting things always happen in Roswell every year during the anniversary special. He talked about the 50-year special, which was in his term, 1997, and we are coming up here right now with 64 years, this July 4th, and we have lots of Roswell shows to do yet. By the way, if you'd like to hear all our Roswell programming, we have it all, and it's available at jerrypippin.com. jerrypippin.com. Click on Roswell. Go to the UFO Files button at the top, and then you'll see another button that says Roswell, and there's a picture of the headline, and I believe an Army officer's picture's there as well. And click on it. All kinds of programs, including a radio drama about Roswell, performed before a live audience in Roswell, New Mexico. I think you'll find it very, very interesting. That's at jerrypippin.com, all one word, Jerry Pippin, P-I-P-P-I-M-P as in Paul. I got a very interesting email note from Richard and Dagmar Shoup. They're with the Roswell UFO Merchants, a group of independent small businesses from Roswell. They banded together to create a new venue, something different for this year's 64th anniversary observation of the 1947 Roswell UFO crash. They have put together what I think is a very interesting event. It'll be running between July 1st and July 4th, actually running from 9 o'clock in the morning until midnight each night. They're calling it the Roswell Encounter. They have been working on this project day in and day out. This is located right down the street from the UFO Museum at Main and 2nd Street. It's in downtown Roswell. You'll see the building there. It's called Planet Roswell. Planet Roswell. Now, they're going to have a series of lectures by some pretty well-known people. Paula Harris will be there. Dennis Malthizer. Dr. Don Burleson, the New Mexico State MUFON director. And Chuck and Debbie will be there. They have an interesting brother-sister team in ufology. And Jesse Marcel Jr., along with the MC for the event, Peter Robbins. Peter's always done a great job with the city, and now he's doing it with these merchants. And I would recommend you go there if you go to Roswell this year. By the way, astronaut Story Musgrave will be there as well. He'll be there lecturing. It's an interesting story to tell. Musgrave was a member of the five-man crew of the Space Shuttle Columbia on a mission that lasted 17 days, 15 hours, and 54 minutes. It was the longest flight in the history of the vehicle. Now, during this lengthy flight in space, a very strange event occurred. Musgrave saw it. He observed it through the shuttle windows. It was a large disc-shaped object that appeared just below the Columbia. The shuttle was approximately 190 nautical miles high at the time. The disc was flying through clouds below and progressing from the right to the left as the astronauts stared out in utter amazement. The outer rim of the craft appeared to be rotating counterclockwise. It appeared to be about 150 feet in diameter. Musgrave describes the event quite well in his presentations, I understand. Talks about lightning flashing from storms on Earth, and he could see the city lights of Denver, and then there was this object. I know in his presentation he shows some slides. He shows one of a gray in his speech, and he says, quote, "These guys are real. I guarantee it." Speaking of aliens, Bobby Clark will also be there. He played the Gorm captain, among other things, on the original Star Trek series. And if you have a chance, I would urge you to go to Roswell and attend this event. If you've never done it, or if you've been there, you know it can be quite, quite educational, intellectual, and fun all at the same time. Now we're going to play some interviews we did in Roswell, New Mexico. One of them at the UFO Museum, and the other, Dennis Malthizer, came over to our hotel while we were there. And I think you'll enjoy both interviews. The first one is by Tom Carey, and these were recorded back in 2007. But they're still interesting listening.
This is Jerry Pippin. Welcome to the UFO Files, another broadcast from the International UFO Museum and Research Center here in Roswell, New Mexico. And we have probably one of the premier researchers as far as Roswell is concerned, and that's Tom Carey. He has a book out called Witness to Roswell, and you wrote that with Don Schmidt, right?
That's right.
Is it out already?
Yes, we wrote it last year. And it's been out a little less than a year.
And basically, you were involved in the digs, too, correct?
Correct.
Why don't you tell us, bring us up to date on what happened there exactly.
Oh, sure.
And we'll talk about the book a little bit.
Sure. The Roswell archaeology dig was something that Don and I had always wanted to do. When we both were members of QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, the QFOS conducted a dig, a preliminary dig in 1989. The plan was always to go back and to conduct a full-scale dig rather than just a preliminary dig.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the funding was never there, so when Don Schmidt and I hooked up together exclusively to work together in 1988, one of the first things that we did was to put together a proposal to try to find funding from somebody to allow us to conduct the dig. At that time, the Sci-Fi Channel was embarking on a UFO project, and we were put in touch with the Sci-Fi Channel by a third-party intermediary, and that was May of 2002, and the dig followed 3 months after that.
And, of course, we were. That was the big discussion last year, and you've had a year since then. What came out of that dig? Did we find anything at all?
The dig, Don and I had several...
First of all, I guess we probably need to explain that this was done scientifically through the University of New Mexico.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being that we had been to the crash site a number of times, and we didn't want to be in the position of discovering a piece of physical evidence without the authority of somebody who was controlling the site, a nonpartisan. We didn't want to have an Uncle Harry type situation where, you know, Aunt Lucy or Uncle Harry said, "Look what I found," and then try to go public with something like that. We wanted it to be a strictly controlled situation with archaeologists there, and if we found something, they could record it as they would any other archaeological find. So that's what we had in mind, and we approached the University of New Mexico, and they were willing to do it, much to our surprise, and they were actually eager to do this because it's a New Mexico story.
So basically you were looking for foreign objects of any kind?
Physical evidence, yes. We had certain things we were hoping to find. The first, the biggest item, of course, would be a physical piece of the ship. Most notably, what we call the memory metal, where you could curl it up in your hand and put it down on a flat surface, and it would unfurl without a crease, and you couldn't cut it, burn it, scratch it, or anything. That's what we were hoping for. On down the line, any other piece of the ship that had a hardness that we can't duplicate. And the minimum thing that we were hoping to find was evidence of a gouge. Now, it's been reported by certain witnesses that they recall seeing a gouge where this thing allegedly struck the earth, dug in the ground. Now, this is hard ground out there. This would, if we found evidence of a gouge, it would eliminate a weather balloon or a mogul balloon, any type of balloon array. So that's what our expectations and hopes
were. Did you find that gouge?
Yes.
I thought I'd read that.
Yes. We have pictures of it, and to us it forms a perfect V in the subsurface, the substrate soil, where it's all been filled in the ensuing 50-odd years. But if you take a slice of it, like you're slicing through a piece of birthday cake, you can see the layers, and you can see almost a perfect V in the soil. And to us, that's evidence of the gouge.
Have you... received any other interesting information out of this examination
well,
with the University of New Mexico yet?
The artifacts, the University of New Mexico termed anything that was found that could not be identified by them, they would call them HMUOs. It stood for Historical Material of Uncertain Origin. Now, something like a projectile point from a Native American is not a HMUO. It's an artifact, but it's not a HMUO because its origin is certain. So anything that they couldn't identify went into a bag for analysis.
And I heard you had
quite a few bags.
Well, we also did soil samples, and this is so interesting. We did find a number of humuos, things we found out in the desert underneath the surface of the soil that the archaeologists couldn't identify. We also, what we did is we took soil samples of the soil around the area of the gouge where this thing impacted. And according to the archaeologists, the laboratory analysis that they normally do for such things, because the archaeologists do that all the time when they excavate a site. They examine the soil contents. And as I understand it from Dr. William Dolman, the lead archaeologist, the soil samples from the area of the gouge differed from what they call the control samples from away from the site. So there was a difference in content. What that difference is at this moment in time, I don't know, but we think it's something significant.
Are we awaiting a further examination report from them?
The examination
report. I'm kind of curious where it stands.
Yes, where it stands is, and not to promote our book, but we're here,
that's part of the deal. It's an interesting read too.
The book that is coming out next week. It's called The Roswell Dig Diaries, and it's published by the Sci-Fi Channel with major contributions from Dr. William Dolman, the lead archaeologist, myself, and Don Schmidt. The final report from the dig of 2002 is a chapter in the book. Now, I've just gotten my copy, so I haven't read it, so...
Is Sci-Fi Channel going to do another feature on this as well?
That is the plan. Mm-hmm. That is the plan. I understand, however, the Sci-Fi Channel has actually been purchased by NBC.
Yes.
So...
How that impacts everything. They
correct.
Are really doing some pretty innovative things there for a little while.
Yes, yes. So... Right now, certainly Don and I plan to go forward with a follow-up dig, irregardless of who funds it. We're certainly Sci-Fi has the first shot at this because they were so good to us in funding the original. And if they said today, let's go do it, that's the way it would be. But irregardless, we have to move forward on this follow-up dig, and that's our plan.
Now, you live in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, just outside of Philadelphia.
Now, how did you get interested in Roswell?
Well, as a teenager, I was interested in UFOs. And then when I read the original Roswell book, The Roswell Incident, 1980, that was it for me. I said, this is the most...
You were hooked.
I was hooked. This is the most interesting aspect of the UFO phenomenon is... what they call crash retrievals, because it has the promise of physical evidence.
Oh, I agree with you.
That not only statistically is there other life in the universe, but that it actually came here.
Now, you've been studying UFO crashes other than Roswell, too, I'm sure, not necessarily.
Actually, no.
No, you haven't. Okay.
No.
You've just been locked in on this one. This is the one.
This is the attorney Frank Galvin said in the film The Verdict, played by Paul Newman, this is the case, this is the only case. Don Schmidt has a day job, I have a day job, so there's only so many hours in the day. And I know Don for the last, I'm not a good mathematician, since 1988 and myself since 1991, this is the only case that we have been investigating.
Okay, you've been working at least a decade and a half on this project. What's the first thing that comes to my mind when you talk to somebody that's been involved in something over a period of years like that is, did it turn out at this point like you thought it might when you started?
When I started, I certainly... said, based on the original book and then the work that Randall and Schmidt had been doing, my curiosity was certainly piqued, and I was sympathetic to what they were saying. now in investigating the case. The investigation has been much more difficult than I had imagined.
That's what I was getting to, is you're from Pennsylvania. You probably, I don't know if you've been out in this part of the country or in the world before, but it's...
21 times.
But
to Roswell.
Yeah, but back then, you hadn't been here that many times, and you probably didn't appreciate how desolate it was.
Correct,
It was.
Right,
I live in this part of the country, not exactly here in Oklahoma, but I still don't appreciate it till I get out here.
When you go out in the desert, it is certainly, and Don and I have been lost out there several times, it is certainly a lonely feeling.
When you came to Roswell the first time, what was your, you hadn't met Don yet, right? Or had you?
No, in fact, Don and I only meet when we're in Roswell, because
okay.
He lives in Wisconsin and I live in Pennsylvania, so... We only meet when we're down here.
I guess what I'm getting at before we go to the break here is, you know, in reporting we get the feeling when you get to a story and you still don't have any facts, but you just have a feeling there's something there.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
We certainly had the... Listen, we are following the facts. If the facts lead to a weather balloon, we will tell your audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you that the facts, the testimony, everything that we are getting over the last 15 or so years has been leading to one conclusion, that in fact it was a UFO that crashed in 1947.
When we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out about the stories of the victims and what you found out. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin. Our guest, of course, is... Tom Carey, and we'll talk about his new book and his sci-fi project as well, and the book he wrote with Dick Schmidt here in a moment. I'm Jerry Pippin. This is the UFO Files. We're broadcasting from the UFO Research Library, actually, here at the International UFO Museum. I'm Jerry Pippin. We have with us Tom Carey, witness to Roswell. Tom, you've been having several lectures and roundtable discussions, and you had a pretty interesting one this morning, I understand. I'm sorry I missed it. I know Don Schmidt is here, and as well as Stanton Friedman, all of you have been involved in the same subject.
Yes.
But it seems to me, as long as you guys have been doing it, you still come up with new information all the time.
That's what keeps us going. We are on this case, we are investigating this case to one of several alternatives happens. We solve the case, which is the most optimal choice. We solve the case, go on to another one. Either that, or we run out of witnesses. And I have to tell you that the primary witnesses from the time period are mostly all gone.
Yeah, the time is getting you on that one.
Yes, it's the World War II generation we're talking about, and they're mostly, according to government statistics on the veterans, they're less than a quarter of the veterans who served in World War II are still with
alive.
Us. Yes.
So that is a problem. Then you end up getting second.
Yes,
and third,
we find ourselves almost exclusively now talking to the children who are themselves now getting old. We had one of the children pass on 2 weeks ago from the sheriff's office here, and who was the sheriff back in 47. His daughter passed away 2 weeks ago. Even the grandchildren are now in their late teens and early 20s. And the third thing that might happen is Don or I pass on before we solve this. Those are the three terminal events.
Let's hope the final terminal event doesn't happen. You basically are doing your research away from official government sources, correct?
Absolutely. We do not expect anything from the government. They say it was a weather balloon, and we have no expectations that they will release any data. We're not even looking in that direction. There is one item, though. It's called the Ramey Memo. It's just a telex that General Ramey, who was the architect of the Roswell cover-up, is holding in his hand when his picture was taken back in the 1947.
Right, it's an interesting little photograph. Why don't you give me your take on it? I know Rudiak, we had him recently. And
David Rudiak, yeah. Yes. My take on it, certainly Rudiak has done the best work on it. And he has been able to, quote-unquote, read more than anybody else. But it's clear that the memo itself, it's not the general's laundry list or his or grocery list or his furniture packing list. It's talking about the most powerful phrase in the memo is victims of the wreck. What sort of balloon has victims? It's right there. You can see it. We know the origin of this memo. It's in the general's hand, and it's talking about victims of the wreck. It's talking about flying material out. It's talking about staging weather balloon demonstrations to try to cover this thing up. It's all there in the memo. So we are still working on that, hoping to get more out of it, but I think Rudiak has, in fact, gone about as far as you can with that. The other thing we're doing is we're searching for the original. We're searching for the original. And I've talked to certain people who are professional archivists. One fellow, his name is Robert Stinnett. He recently wrote a book, well, it was in the 2000, on Pearl Harbor, where he spent 20 years in the government archives, and he has given me a good lead as to where this particular telex might be.
Good, I hope you find it.
I know
so
you do, too.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It would be incredible.
That's a piece of physical documentary evidence.
So as far as you know, there's no physical evidence laying around here that...
We believe that whatever crashed there in 47... because of anecdotal testimony, the wind blew a lot of it around. And the idea is that if we're going to find a piece of that memory metal, we are actually not going to find it near the area of the gouge where most of the dig took place. We're going to find it in the periphery of the debris field or even away from the debris field where the wind had blown it. But that's a one in a million needle in a haystack situation. But that's where we're going to find it.
Well, basically, the reason I'm getting into that question is I want to know where you are actually going right now. I mean, you after all this time and research, you're bound to have a hunch,
yes.
Something that you're following, or at least that's
sure.
Kind of the way I,
sure.
I do my work. And
we have found we have been given leads as to individuals who might possess a piece of this memory metal. So
it's conceivable, even at this point, so many years later, that somebody saved it, put it away in a trunk,
yes.
Passed it on to the children, and they have no idea what it is.
That's possible. That's entirely possible. But we also have leads of people who are holding pieces. And it's our goal to visit with them, because we haven't visited them yet. But heretofore, all claims, I have to say, all claims of physical evidence have not borne fruit.
They've not turned out.
Right.
And that has to be frustrating. Right?
Absolutely.
I'm sure you get your hopes up.
Yes. Because when we get a lead on physical evidence, everything else, we drop everything else. And,
what do you think actually involved in this crash really happened? I mean, many beings and et cetera?
Okay. There, first of all, as far as the number of craft involved, there's to Don and myself, there's only evidence of one. Others have maintained that maybe there was a collision in the air, and then one went to the plains of San Augustine, and one went down towards Roswell. We believe there was only one involved. As far as bodies, that's the a very interesting point. We believe there were approximately five bodies, potentially eight involved. Three having been found up on the ranch by Mac Brazel. And
is his son still alive?
Bill Jr. died this year.
That's what I was thinking.
Yes, Bill Jr. died this year. But I interviewed one of Mac Brazel's nieces this year, and she confirmed for us that Mac told her about finding what he called those unfortunate little creatures, because they didn't use the term aliens back in 47.
Sure.
An alien was someone from another country,
right,
but they called them creatures. Yes. Unfortunate little creatures is what Mac called them. So he found, we believe, two or three, and then there were up to five, somewhere between three and five, located with the final impact of the craft north of town.
Do you think they were all dead? Or did you know?
No. We have testimony from several people that one, perhaps two, were alive.
Did when you know, you heard all these stories from people, a lot of it's hearsay, a lot of it's extra, you know, second and third party.
Yes.
But
if you get enough here,
you flush it out in your mind, at least when you hear all of this. Circumstantial, but still, you can get a good idea.
If there's enough of it, you can piece it together.
Right. And that's exactly where you guys are going. But my point is, what do these creatures really look like? Are they like the ones here in the museum?
That's a good question, because we have had several stories of what they look like. We don't believe they had those large wraparound eyes that you see with the abduction cases. Conversely, there was a gentleman a few years ago who claimed he was heavily involved, and said that they looked like 10-year-old children, much like it, just with a little larger head than a 10-year-old child. We do not believe that anymore either. We think they were similar to your classic grays. Short in stature. Let's say they were short in stature.
Probably 2 to 3.
Yes, 3 to 4.
Okay.
3 to 4 feet. Not those black wraparound eyes, but not eyes. They were more like mongoloid eyes, but very similar to ours. A little larger, but like mongoloid. No nose, no ears, and no mouth. Just a slit for a mouth, and then long, spindly arms and legs. But that's the best we have right now.
So they were probably classic grays, small.
Except with the black eyes.
I talked to Glenn Dennis here at the museum several times, and of course he never actually got to see
anything.
It seems to be pretty normal. I mean, many, many people have a story that they're all short.
Right. The other witnesses we interviewed, one referred to them as little people, about 3 feet tall. So they're calling them little people, little creatures.
Was the craft pretty much destroyed, or?
That's another good question. All good questions. There was so much material spread around the Foster Ranch that you figured, geez, there couldn't be much left. But we believe that there was part of it still left, which ultimately impacted north of town, and that possibly an escape pod, came down 2.5 miles from the crash site, from the Foster Ranch.
That's an interesting concept, the escape pod. That sounds logical, too. We'll be back in a moment. We're talking about the crash of Roswell. And, of course, the name of the book is Witness to Roswell by Tom Carey. And your new book is, what's it called?
The Roswell Dig Diaries.
And we'll find out a little bit more about that, too, when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. You're listening to the UFO Files.
We're talking with Tom Carey here. Let's talk about Witness to Roswell. This tell us a little bit about this book, Tom. By the title, I'm sorry, I haven't read it yet.
My wife actually came up with the title. It was a compilation of 18 standalone chapters of key witness testimony, with the emphasis on visual material, photographs that I took mostly. And the idea was to put it into a magazine format that was, 8.5 by 11, that was easy to read, compelling testimony with pictures. and the feedback that we've gotten on it has been very gratifying.
What sort of pictures for our audience are you talking about?
Well, pictures that have never before been published, such as the bomb pit area number one on the old Roswell Army Air Force Base. This is where they loaded up the bodies to fly to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We have statements from crew members as to where this was and what they did. And we actually went out there a year or two ago. You have to get permission. You just can't walk right out there because this is an operating airport now. So we went out to the bomb pit area and interviewed the gentleman who was on the craft. So we have pictures of the bomb pit area. We have new photos of the Foster Ranch. We have photos of the people involved. These are photos that have never been published.
When you talk about the gentleman who was on the craft that took it to Wright-Patterson, did he get a chance to see the wing?
No. What happened was that they were out.
I mean, it'd be interesting to explain how they work.
Yes.
I mean, you know, because the first thing people do is, well, how can these people not know much about this?
Well, they knew something was up because this was an unscheduled flight. And they were actually out on the skeet shooting. They were off duty, and their commanding officer came by, and a jeep said, yeah, get ready for a special flight. So they went back to the barracks, suited up, and went out, and they said, report to bomb pit number one. And this is where they used to load up the atomic bombs. And so they're standing there, and a B-29 taxis up, and they're ordered to look away from the craft.
Literally, they said, don't look.
Yes. But, of course, they
peek. It's an invitation.
So they turned
around. Like, I don't know if you heard the story about the Northwest Airline pilot that landed at the Air Force Base by mistake the other day. Up in South Dakota, Rapid City, the commercial airport's right over the hill.
Right.
And the Air Force made everybody pull the shades down and don't look. Well, I can just imagine those passengers sitting there not looking.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So the whole crew, they're facing away from the craft, looking away. But, you know, they looked over their shoulder, and they could see that they were loading up not an atomic bomb, but a crate, a wooden crate that was about 4 by 6 by about 16, just long enough for about 4 3-foot bodies, 4-foot bodies. So the talk on the plane was that they were related to the crash and that they were actually...
So that this was already around the scuttle.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. It was around the base in... Yes, yes. So they flew on to Fort Worth, Texas, and the crate was taken off the B-29 and put onto another craft that went on to Wright-Patterson. And they picked up Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer who had been at Fort Worth being part of that press conference where they talked about the weather balloons. So they flew him back to Roswell, and when they took off, the navigator on the B-29, but going back to Roswell, his name was Felix Martucci. He said, boys, we just made the history books. Now, what kind of balloon delivery would you make the history books?
Right.
So that was the significance of bomb pit number one. Okay, so we have other shots of...
You've never run across anyone that was in charge of creating up the bodies or anything, have you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, have you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, great.
Yes. The gentleman, Robert Smith, was... what they did, here's what they did. There were two sets of bodies. The first set went out with a Captain Orville Pappy Henderson. And he flew them to Wright-Patterson, and he actually saw the bodies. They brought them to the hangar Building 84, known as Hangar P3 back then. But there they were lying on the cement floor of the hangar, and he talked about that in a compelling statement. That seeing the bodies on the floor, one was alive. And that was the first group of bodies from the impact of the craft itself. Later on, they brought in what we call the smelly bodies. These were the bodies that were up at the Foster Ranch that Mac Brazel had found. They had been laying out longer than they were getting...
So they actually were decaying. or at least they smelled.
Oh, yes, the smelly bodies. And Glenn Dennis talked about the being in the hospital and that everybody had a towel over their face because the smell was so bad. These were the bodies from the Foster Ranch. Those bodies, the smell was so bad, they stored them in a tent at the extreme south end of the base. And they were guarded by Native Americans from Colorado because they felt that they could be trusted. So when it was time to ship them, they crated them up and put them at bomb pit number one. So we have testimony from several of the soldiers who had been constructing those crates for the wreckage in the bodies.
The one that was alive, was it making any? I didn't think they ever made any sound.
We have no direct testimony of any sounds that they made. We don't. We know that one appeared to be perhaps injured, perhaps mortally injured, and another one seemed to be okay, and there's rumors that it lived until 1952, and they called it Eva.
And just to break in, this is a pre-recorded interview of Tom Carey. We did all the way back in 2004 at the Roswell UFO Museum. Back to the interview.
Talking about an incredible book, and I tell you, just a little bit we've discussed about it here on the air, it really gets my imagination going. I'm going to have to pick this book up and take a look at it, Tom Carey, and I apologize once again for not reading it before the interview. Witness to Roswell is the name of the book.
There's one chapter in it, I just to give you a flavor for it, it's called If You Talk, You Will Be Killed. And this is precisely what they did to the civilians. See, the military participants, they could ship out to other bases, and they could order them not to talk, which they did. But the civilians were not under the direct control of the military. And, in fact, some of the civilians said, there's nothing you can do to me. I'm a civilian. And they say, well, we'll show you what we can do. So what they did is they enlisted the local sheriff to put the hammer on the civilian participants. And what the local sheriff did is he went around to them and they said, you're not going to talk about this, are you? And well, you better not talk, because if you do talk, you will be killed. So that would be an impressive statement to me if I'm a civilian back in 1947.
And especially if it was the sheriff telling him that, because he has a gun.
Absolutely, and he had his deputy with him, who looked like a middle linebacker.
So my intimidation, they kept it quiet, and of course in the military you had a loss of retirement, loss of promotion, everything else.
Yes, yes. And what we found in our conducting interviews over the years, the military least likely to talk have been the careerists. The ones who've been in for 20, they're on pension, they're the least likely to talk. The ones that are most likely to talk are ones that got in and got out.
Now, when we talk about Witness to Roswell, and you've obviously done quite a lot of research on this book, and the book, you know, with the interesting photographs and the way you talk about it, I mean, it's just to get you on the edge of your chair listening to you talk about it. I mean, you had to be really carried away with some of the things they were telling you.
Absolutely. What happens is when we get a new witness, and even though we've been on the case 15 years, a chill goes down our spine. When we get a new witness, it's just thrilling to us.
Well, I imagine the adrenaline flows and the excitement at the same time.
Yes, yes.
Any new witnesses this trip out? Got to get an exclusive.
On this trip, we are still working on one that we found on our last trip. We've been so busy on this trip with the festival and doing interviews that we haven't had a chance to get out into the field and actually.
Would you going to do that before you leave?
Yes, yes. But we do have a new witness that we found the last trip who was actively involved in the recovery from the site to the hangar and at the hospital where they did the autopsies.
So actually, this new witness saw the bodies.
Yes.
Was at the hospital with them, so was there when they transported them.
Yes.
And
he is still a work in progress. He was very reluctant to talk to us. And he was very emotional when he was telling us about this.
I don't want to get any trade secrets here, but I guess you were tipped about him or something? Or?
We had a third party notify us of this particular individual. They live in the same town. And even with that, we used her as the intermediary. It was very difficult, and we were thankful that we were able to meet with him because he didn't want to meet with us originally.
In fact, this seems to be one of the regular scenarios. These people just really don't want to talk about these things.
The regular scenario is this. You have a friend, they will say, hey, you know, don't tell anybody, but I was involved in that Roswell case back in 47. This is what I did, blah, 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 blah. Don't tell anybody. They come here to the museum, and there's something about the museum that people open up. And they tell the director, who then tells us. We try to interview the person, and normally the original source, it's very difficult to get them to talk. They will either deny it or say, well, I have nothing to say.
And a lot of times, I imagine they say, I don't have anything to say, and if you keep talking to them, if they'll stay around long enough, you can probably get them to open up.
Sometimes, yes, sometimes. Sometimes they're not too pleasant, but that's the chance we take. But it's very, very difficult. And people who have offered to help us on this case, this is a scenario they can't seem to overcome. It's the rejection, because we meet a lot of rejection.
Well, I imagine so. You make a good siding salesman. I'm teasing. It's a joke. Anyway, we of course are talking with Tom Carey here, and we're talking about Witness Roswell. And we're at the UFO, the International UFO Museum and Research Center, and this is quite a research center in here.
Yes, yes. This is the central focus for all Roswell information, both incoming and outgoing. And we feel lucky to be associated with it because this is where the new leads are coming.
And as you say, they do open up when they come here to the museum.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting, and at the same time, I guess, understandable in
yes.
a way.
Yes, because you see all of the displays, and you start thinking, well, geez, I have something to add.
Sure.
And that's the way it works.
And so a lot of people don't think about it, but they just when they formed this museum and put it here, they really did a big public service as far as information.
The museum itself is the top attraction, tourist attraction, in all of New Mexico. It's one of the top 20 in the nation. And it started, I think, in 91 or 92 from the old, some building, and we're now in the, I think it's the former Plains Theater.
Yeah, they still have the marquee out front, or at least it looks like a movie theater. It's a very interesting place, and it's got a good history in itself. We, of course, are talking about Roswell, and I want to talk about the digs before we close out the show here, because you're very interested in that. I guess your main focus is the Witness Avenue, or what?
Well, we have several main focuses and or foci. Of course, whatever comes along, we will take. But it's the search for physical evidence is number one. Number two is the new witnesses that can corroborate what's already gone forward, and document search. So. That's where we're focused.
It's amazing, you know, but you mentioned document search, and all of a sudden, out of some place where people have been four or five times, I imagine somebody else finds something sometimes.
Well,
just kind of works out. I know that picture, for instance, you were talking about earlier. And before computers, people didn't pay much attention to that, but it was able to blow up the print now.
Correct. Before computers, they just did... optical enhancement, but
We're gonna wrap up the show when we come right back and talk about the scientific angle here.
There's still some questions I have about DIG, and maybe it'll be future DIGs, right, Tom?
Yes.
We're working on that. At least they are. I'm Jerry Pippin. This is the UFO Files. Tom Carey, let's talk about the new book. It's just out. And it's incredible. Science fiction channel, of course, the Sci-Fi Channel, I guess they were instrumental in publishing this book,
yes,
as well?
It was a Sci-Fi Channel publication. The publisher was Simon & Schuster, the Pocketbooks division.
Now you can, of course, get those books at any bookstore, including this one, I imagine, and
yes,
you have a way to sell it on your website too, I imagine, or a link,
yes,
at least.
We have a link from our website for both Witness to Roswell and the one will be put up for the Roswell Dig Diaries. I think the complete title is Sci-Fi Channel Declassified, the Roswell Dig Diaries. But on the cover it just says the Roswell Dig Diaries. They will be at all your local bookstores next week, as I understand it. And certainly you can purchase them there or at the museum here in Roswell over the internet.
Interesting thing about this scientific angle is that a lot of people, you know, the debunkers go along and they sometimes don't take into account some of the scientific examples that you've come up with already. And if you get to continue, the University of New Mexico is still helping you, correct?
Yes, they are committed. Whoever will fund our next dig, we're still going with the University of New Mexico.
And they do have the expertise because they're in this part of the country.
Absolutely.
So they know what is foreign.
They are experts for this area, and we've just used techniques that they normally use in any archaeological dig. That's all we asked of them.
So you're looking for that magic metal.
The memory metal,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and you seem convinced that exists, or at least it did.
We've had so many descriptions of it from people that we trust their opinion. Bill Brazel Jr., for one. He described it that he found the piece 2 years after the event up on the ranch. And he described its properties. Another witness here in town, Frankie Rowe, her father was a fireman who was out to the site. She saw a piece of the firehouse, and she vividly described how it would just flow out like liquid mercury on the table, and you couldn't cut it, scratch it, or deform it in any way. So the thing about the memory metal is that you don't have to send it away to a laboratory and wonder whatever happened to it 2 years later. You can tell that this is something extraordinary. You can see it right in front of you. So that's why we're looking for that. Say a piece of a ship that's a rigid piece, again, with strong properties, you would have to send that away to be analyzed. And most of the, not most, but all of physical evidence that have been sent away, we never hear any more about them.
What happens?
Don't know. It's either, usually you can speculate that it never was.
And just, you knew you sent that package, but they never got it?
They either never got it, someone else intercepted it, or when they analyzed it, it really wasn't really what was cracked up to be.
Final question before we let you go here. Have you had any intimidation factors yourself in
this
investigation? None of
them? No.
From nobody, so other than people reluctant, they're not upset, they didn't want to talk to you, but I mean,
right.
Nothing official.
No, absolutely not.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Have fun out here in New Mexico, and have a nice trip back to Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Jerry. It's been my pleasure.
I tell you, lots of things are happening in New Mexico. For instance, Nancy Wallace, our good friend, who has a benefit for a really fine project she has for boys and girls and a special school for them. You can go over to the website at wakeupnowconference.com and check it out, or enter it into Google. It's going to be held at the Santa Ana Star Casino and that's right outside Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it'll be going on April 29th, April 30th, and May 1st. And our good friend Dolores Cannon will be there, among others. Norio Hayakaiwa will also be there, and quite a few speakers. I really urge you to take the time to check out that that website and see for yourself exactly what's happening there. And if you're in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area, there are all kinds of tickets available for per session or per day or for the whole thing. Just simply go to http://wakeupnowconference.com. Goes April 29th, April 30th, and May 1st. And it goes for a good cause, besides spreading light and understanding.
This is the UFO Files from Roswell, New Mexico. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we have our good friend Dennis Balthizer here, who lives here and has one of the great websites around, and one of our favorite people. Dennis, how are you?
I'm fine. A little tired.
Well, you've been busy.
Been a busy weekend, really has.
These people really turn out here in Roswell for this UFO celebration every year. At carnivals, even Willie Nelson was here.
That's one of the reasons I'm tired. I went to see Willie.
I was going to ask you if you saw it.
That's my bedtime.
Right, and we talked about it on the air one time before. At one time in your life, you were a country music drummer.
In fact, I worked with Willie in El Paso back in the early 60s. I have a picture at home of Willie Nelson with short hair in a tuxedo.
Yeah, we talked about that, too, when he had short hair, crew cut, actually. Changed a little.
Yeah,
huh?
Time's taking its toll on both of us.
Well, I wanted to get out there to see that. That was at the fairgrounds, but
I understand they had around 6,000 people there.
Well, that's good.
Big crowd.
That's good.
It's good.
In fact, they had the Temptations and a few old-time rock groups the night before in town, and so everything, and they had the parade. The parade seemed to be a little better this year.
That's what I understand, and they had a lot of activities for the people in addition to just the UFO activities. If people wanted to come here, there was a lot to do.
Now, let's talk about what's happening in your life with ufology. I've been reading your editorials.
Still writing them about every other month, and I've now taken on the approach of trying to get after some of these people that are putting out misinformation and disinformation.
Yeah, we talked about that. We did that on the last show, and what's the latest on that?
Well, I'm getting pretty positive feedback, surprisingly. It's time that the researchers do this, the serious researchers, because we're spending so much time putting out fires from people who don't have the knowledge or don't have the research, and yet have the ability to get out and spread the word on things that they can't back up. And that bothers me as a serious researcher. So I have gone public with it, and privately it didn't work in the past, so I just decided to go public and take my chances with it.
And I know we were talking to Stanton Friedman the other morning at breakfast, and he was talking about some of these people look like, you know, they're really telling you they're every honest to God truth, known to mankind. They look like you could pass a lie detector test, and none of it's true.
A good example is the Roswell incident. There's over 2,000 websites on the Roswell incident. And of those, I would wager that 80% are probably done by people who have never been to Roswell, never interviewed a witness, don't know where the crash sites are or anything else. It's second, third-hand research.
Well, you got a good point there. 2,000, huh?
2,000 websites, and luckily I understand I have one of the top 10.
Well, I'm sure you do, and that's let's give that website for our radio listeners. We have a link on our website.
www.truthseeker@roswell.com.
truthseeker@roswell.com. Now, Dennis, what's the latest project? You were up in Aztec again this year, I know.
I was Master of Ceremonies, and they have a new board there. The Aztec Symposium is set up to benefit the public library in Aztec, and they just elected a new board for the committee and have already started making plans for next March for the next symposium.
So it's going to go on again. Good.
It is.
It's been doing it for some time now.
And Aztec, like Stanton Friedman and I have talked about, years past, Aztec was one of those incidents that we weren't sure about. But the more research that's being done, the more it looks like it's an actual event that did take place, and we're getting some good information with some of the researchers that are working on it.
Well, I know one of the things that you are an expert on, or at least you,
watch that word.
You specialize in studying and researching is underground bases, things like that. And there's one close to there.
I was fortunate this,
supposedly.
This weekend. I was fortunate with Dr. Salter, Richard Salter, being in town. I had communicated with him several times by email and phone over the years, and finally got to meet him, but the one you're referring to is up at Dulce. And there's a lot of rumors about seven levels below ground, biogenetics taking place there, and things like that. And this base, if it exists, is located on the Jicarilla Apache Indian Reservation, which would be a good location for security because of the federal laws, the Native American laws, and the state laws to cover it. So it's probably one of those locations that is going to be extremely hard to find and get information about.
Yeah, you got three different sets of laws. Like you say, if one doesn't get you, the other one probably will.
Right, and they will use them just like they do out of Area 51 if they need to.
I heard, and this is another place where you're an expert on, and we'll get into that in a minute, but okay, you specialize in that.
How's that work?
Oh, okay. And let me ask you about that Dulce rumor that there's a nice hotel up there or something in the middle of nowhere.
There is a 3-star, 4-star hotel in Dulce, and I had tried to work a deal to get up there with two other researchers, one from North Carolina and one from Georgia, and we were going to go up there under the cover of a hunting trip or a fishing trip or something like that to snoop around a little bit, and I got a call from the one guy in Georgia saying that he's getting out of the Dulce research completely. Reason being, he's getting a lot of threatening phone calls, and he's having near accidents and things like that anytime he mentions Dulce. So somebody apparently is putting some pressure on him, and it's something we need to look at carefully. Don't want to publicly let anybody know if we decide to go up and when we decide to go.
Well, see, that lets me out.
Well, I can give you after the fact.
Oh, okay. Okay. I may go up there with you.
I had a man up there 2 years ago that came up to me. He knew I was interested in Dulce, and he was a Native American. And he said, "I understand you're interested in Dulce." I said, "I am." He said, "Well, I'm a guide." And I said, "Well, I'd like to talk to you." And he said he'd be willing to work with me, but he wanted to wait a few years for some reason. He didn't tell me why. So I'm going to buy a little time on it and then get a hold of him and see if maybe we can do some research.
Yeah, you'd like to find out more about that place. All kinds of things in New Mexico. I guess that's one reason you came here.
It is, and it's New Mexico itself is probably one of the best-kept secrets in the country. But the activity that takes place in New Mexico is unbelievable. You have two national labs in Sandia and Los Alamos, White Sands Missile Range, which is highly technical and highly secretive at places, Holloman Air Force Base, where the stealth F-117 is housed, the base over at Clovis, the VLA, the very large array, the dishes that are listening for signals from space is out of Sequoia.
Yeah, New Mexico has got lots of history behind it, especially in UFOs. I've heard of reports of as many as 10 reported crashes in this state.
Larry Hatch has a website where he has sightings plotted on a map from different years. He has individual states, he has the United States, he has different countries, and it's amazing how many sightings back in the 1940s, particularly 1947, took place. I think there's about 15 or 20 just in New Mexico back in 1947.
Yeah, so this is of course, back in those days, this was the place where, I guess, nuclear weapons were, and all of the research was going on, and
the only atomic
we didn't know.
The only atomic bomb group in the world was stationed here after they dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the Second World War. The Enola Gay was stationed here. The runway here at the base is 13,000 feet, which is one of the longer runways in the country.
Almost as long as
Area 51.
Right.
Yeah. We don't know what they're bringing in at Area 51, but the runway is 30,000 feet. But this was a very vital base at the time. There's 12 missile silos stationed around the city here that were in use back in the 60s. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the B-52 sat on the runway out here for 72 hours, engines idling, crews on board, atomic bombs loaded. Had the word come down, they would have been airborne in 3 minutes.
So when you came to Roswell, you obviously, we all have preconceived ideas about what happened here. Now you've lived here some time, and you've investigated it. Hour after hour after hour, has your mind changed at all from the time your preconceived notion about Roswell till now?
I think the biggest change is the fact that I now have no doubt that something extremely important happened here. Up until the time I moved here, it was reading books or doing research other ways that I could read and get information. But after moving up here, working at the museum as a volunteer for 2.5 years, meeting a lot of the first-hand witnesses, meeting the researchers like Stanton Friedman and John Smith that have been active with it, I have no doubt that what happened in 1947 did happen and is still covered up. What I cannot tell you is what it was. The rumors are, and the stories from the witnesses are, that it was a craft of unknown origin, extraterrestrial. We're pretty well convinced it wasn't anything of the United States. It wasn't anything of Russia. So it would be something that we need to find out.
From Roswell, New Mexico, one of our good friends, Dennis Balthizer, is here. And Dennis, we talked about several things in the opening segment, but you know, you talk about. I like to talk about conspiracies, let's say it that way, more than you do. I mean, that's kind of one of my pets. But you've had some encounters of conspiracies. We ran across that Stillwater story several times when you went to...
Perhaps that's why I don't like talking about
it. Yeah, right. Have you had any, we're talking about your friend that was going to go up and research with you in Dulcea. He kind of backed out because of intimidating phone calls and things. Has anyone ever contacted you like that?
Well, with that interception, I had the phone call 6 months later saying not to mess with the Air Force, back off. And I am currently working with a gentleman in California who we're doing some checking, trying to get names and locations of the people I dealt with. And if that's possible, then one or two scenarios is involved with that thing in Stillwater. If they were real agents, we have a cover-up, without a doubt, 50-some years later. If they were not, then we have a hoax or a scam, and I want to prosecute because they're impersonating federal agents.
Yeah, now let's, for people who are not aware of the story, you were going to go up there to investigate somebody who actually was going to show you material that could have been from an extraterrestrial craft.
Right. I was with the museum at the time as a UFO investigator, and we got a call from a gentleman who said his daddy was stationed here as an MP, had a piece of the metal, guarded the ambulances, saw the bodies, saw one walk into the hospital with doctors and things like that. So I made arrangements to go to Oklahoma to meet him, get him on tape, get the metal and have it tested. And when I got over there, I wasn't able to make contact. I kept getting a recording on the phone, and finally I was contacted and told to meet him at Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. And when I got there, a man and woman said, "Are you Dennis?" I said, "Yes." He said, "The gentleman you plan on meeting will not be here." So when I asked who they were, they said they were special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation. When I said, "How did you know I was coming over?" He said, "We knew Monday you'd be here Friday." So as my phone tapped, he smiled and said, "You know how we do business." So this has been 7 years ago, and it's still under investigation because we're still trying to locate who the people were. And particularly, I'm interested in what their motive was, because usually a hoax or a scam is a big splash to embarrass you or make a fool out of you, where this was pretty low-key and hush-hush and kept under the rug pretty much. They weren't any publicity with it or anything like that, so... We're looking to try to find out who they were. If we can locate them, I have a contact with the FBI, and I would hope that the Air Force would get behind me also, because impersonating federal agents is a pretty serious offense. And if we can prove that, then I want to prosecute and put them away.
We're talking with Dennis Balthaser here. It's truthseeker@roswell.com. I got it right. Sometimes I try to put that S in there to make it plural for some reason. But it's not, folks. It's just truthseeker@roswell.com. Let's talk about some of your other projects that you're on. I don't know about the pyramid deal. What's happening there? As this fellow came to you and asked you about joining their team for pyramid research.
I was recommended by Jeff Renz of Sightings on the Radio, and they were looking for someone to put on the advisory board that has some knowledge of ufology. And Jeff recommended me, which I was appreciative of. There's thoughts and talk about the pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx not being Egyptian. This is going to be a hard sell because of Egyptian tourism. But we're pretty well convinced that the three pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx are predating the Egyptian civilization. There was a civilization there known as Kemetians. Prior to the Egyptian civilization in North Africa, and we have heard rumors that they had contact with star people. So I'm not by any means saying that extraterrestrials built the pyramids, but I am saying the technology could have been transferred from star people to the Kemetians in order to help build those things.
Where does this stand at this point? Has anybody made it over there yet?
We have a group going over in November. Unfortunately, I don't have the money. I'm losing too much money doing research to go.
Oh, we understand.
But there is a group going back in November. Stephen Mueller, I think Joe Parr, and a few others are going over and going to do some research. And they do this every so many years and then come back and go public with the information they've obtained.
Well, we look forward to hearing from them. And they'll be talking to you.
Yes.
You'll be giving them some of your expertise because you were a highway engineer, wasn't that right?
Right. I had 33 years with the Texas Highway Department in civil engineering, 3 years in the Army Engineering Battalion prior to that. So that's one of the reasons I got into the underground bases, because of the technology and the equipment that they use. I was curious to see if I could find anything out about that.
Literally or physically found an underground base yet yourself?
Well, we know there's some down at White Sands. There's at least four levels at White Sands because they've been doing some laser testing in the fourth level at White Sands. There could be seven levels there. Still, C is supposed to have seven levels below ground.
Yes.
Where they encountered the grays. Area 51, 22 levels below ground. Edwards Air Force Base and some of the bases in California are up to 35 levels below ground.
Wow.
And these are things that I can understand because of satellites. We have to go underground. Other countries do it also. The Russians have some. The Koreans have some. We have to do this secretive work away from the eyes of satellites of our adversaries. So it's something that has to be done, and it's being done by many countries.
How do you feel about the whole situation? You've been investigating this for a while. And the situation, when I say the whole situation, I'm talking about the idea that time is really eating away at the Roswell witnesses. They're not around anymore.
The mortician's winning the battle, yeah. Just this past week, we lost Elizabeth Tolk. Your listeners don't know who Elizabeth Tolk is, but Elizabeth was Sheriff Wilcox's daughter, one of his two daughters. And I had the good fortune of meeting Elizabeth and Phyllis a couple of years ago, and going through the old Sheriff Wilcox office and residence where they lived behind the courthouse. And they explained to us how their dad worked in that building, and their mother did the cooking for the prisoners. The jail was upstairs, above their residence, and
so they literally lived in the jail.
They did, back in the 40s, mm-hmm. And we asked the girls, Phyllis and Elizabeth, if they would go up to the jail portion with us, and surprisingly, both women, who were in their late 70s at the time, said, no, we're not going up there. Daddy told us that wasn't a place for women,
mm-hmm.
Which just really hit me because, 50 years later,
half of the inmates are women. No.
they still believe their daddy's words when he said they had no business going up
there.
It
may be one reason they haven't talked a whole lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the sheriff went around and intimidated the civilian witnnesses by saying,
he
might get killed, and he had a Green Bay Packer-looking guard with him. And
he decided not to run for re-election as sheriff, and his wife ran and lost. This incident moved him so much that he didn't even run for re-election. And he was interrogated. They had come to the sheriff's office and confiscated some of the material, armed military people. So it changed his life also, like it has many people. Last year, 2 years ago, we lost Frank Kaufman, who we thought was a key witness with intelligence. Turns out that most of his stuff was hoax that he had worked up his own paperwork on. And I'm thinking about trying to do another editorial in the next month or two on some of the witnesses that we're losing and the fact that we are losing these witnesses.
How many of these witnesses turned out to be just joining the parade, you know?
Well, one of the problems, several problems involved with witnesses.
I mean, like sometimes you do that by, they see a little bit and they talk to other people.
Embellish it.
Yeah, right. I mean, it just happens.
I'll give you an example of that. James Bond Johnson, who took the pictures in General Ramey's office. I did an in-depth interview with him a few years ago and have it on my website. Kevin Randall had also done an interview with him. And between my interview, Kevin Randall's interview, and another interview, his story has completely changed. James Bond Johnson took the pictures in General Ramey's office in Fort Worth in 1947. That's a fact. But that's all he did. But if you listen to his story today, he's more involved. He, in fact, claimed at one time that he had given the piece of paper to General Ramey that Ramey was holding that we're looking at today. Then he came back when I questioned him about that, and he said, well, he's probably wrong about that. But the information had gone out. Memory loss is a problem. The guys are getting older. They're in their late 70s or early 80s if they're still alive, and I'm getting any age now where I know what memory loss is, too.
Now, who are you again?
No, I can't remember.
No, that's a good point.
It is, and it's memory loss is a real thing, and to determine the difference between memory loss, embellishment, and fact are tough research situations.
Well, Dennis Valpizer is our guest. This is the UFO Files. We're in Roswell, New Mexico. Dennis is home now, and Dennis, let's talk about Roswell for a little bit. You've been here a long time, and sometimes you run across these great stories by accident that check out. I know as a researcher that happens.
It does. The interesting thing to me, since I've been here and really been keying on this Roswell incident, is the witnesses. When we get a name for the first time, we get excited because we finally found somebody else that was here that's new that we haven't interviewed before. So we'll call them. I'll try to call them. And when I get a hold of them, I'll tell them that I'm a UFO researcher and I understand you were at Roswell in 1947. Invariably, I will be told, no, I wasn't there. And then I'll tell them, I'm looking at the 1947 Roswell Army Airfield yearbook. Your picture is on page such and such.
Yeah.
Your rank was, you were in this squadron, and then they know I have them. And then the next thing they'll usually tell me is, okay, I was there, but I'm not going to talk about it. And when I question that, there's several reasons. The main one is, I promised my government I wouldn't talk, and they won't. And I have to respect them. A lot of researchers don't. A lot of researchers will push the envelope there and usually make them mad, and they'll never get any information. But I try to respect that because I wish today that we had that respect for our government.
Well, you got a good point. So you, at that point, kind of soft-pedal it, but I bet you come back to them.
I do, and I give them...
Somehow I felt that.
I give them the opportunity to get comfortable, the knowing, and I'll tell them, I'll keep it confidential if you want to keep it confidential, but I have a few questions, and then we'll go into some questions. Sometimes they'll give me answers, sometimes they won't, and I have to take what I give.
Mm-hmm. Anytime in the past come to mind when...
Yeah,
I thought, well, this guy's not going to tell me anything, and maybe as you're getting ready to leave or hang up the phone or something, he says, oh, by the way, it tells you something. That happens to me a lot.
Yeah, I've had those, but the one that would really kick the audience, I think, is Mac Brazel, the rancher. You know, when he came back into town after Major Marcel and Cabot had been out at the site, he was interrogated down here at the base for 5 or 6 days. And he had done an interview with the radio station prior to going to that interrogation.
Okay.
And when they turned him loose to go back to the ranch, he stopped at the radio station and told them that his story wasn't true the way he originally told it, that he had been wrong in the dates and things like that. And the station owner said, "Mac, are you talking about those little green men?" And they said Mac Brassel spun on his cowboy boots and looked at the radio station owner and said they weren't green. In fact, it's the only reference that I'm aware of where Mac Brassel made any reference to bodies, but the fact that he said they weren't green tells me that he did see them.
Yeah, in fact, I think his son was quoted as saying one time about he felt sorry for those poor little creatures
Right. And there's another one. We were talking earlier about losing these witnesses. His son passed away within the last few years, Bill Brassel. And Bill was also one of those that had a piece of metal, bragged about it, and the next thing you know, the military is there demanding it and getting rid of it.
Did he, ever talk to anybody about that metal? Is that where we learned that it had the memory quality?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the same stuff. In fact, Bill, the son of Mac Brassel, had gone out on horseback, I think after a rare rainstorm here, and had found this laying out in the pasture, and had taken it back to the house, to the ranch. And
this is after the Air Force had cleared the area,
definitely.
Or the Army.
After
it had
been cleared, and I think he went into one of the bars in Corona or somewhere and bragged about it. And within a short period of time, he visited by the military and they told him they wanted it.
Word gets around.
D. Proctor, who was Loretta Proctor's son, and went out to the debris field with Mac Brassel the morning after the crash, was about 11 years old at the time. Don Schmidt and I have tried to interview him on many occasions. And if he finds out we're coming, he's unavailable. If he sees us driving up, he's out the back door. We just cannot get with the man. He doesn't want to talk about it. However, you put yourself in his position as a young boy in the military, telling you if you talk about this, your parents are dead or something like that. You know, it's a frightening situation.
So, do you think we'll ever know for sure what happened here?
Good question. Up until fairly recently, I was hopeful that within my lifetime, we would know what happened. My latest theory, which is something that I've thought about for years, on the Roswell incident is whatever we recovered in 1947, I'm not sure that we know today what we have or if we know what it is. And if that's the case, I don't think our military and our government will go public with anything until they get all the military benefit out of it. We have nothing in our day-to-day life that the military hasn't already used. Technology, from the military standpoint, advances about 15 years for every calendar year. So military technology is way ahead of anything else. But I really believe that we possibly have material from this craft that we haven't completely figured out what it is, where it's from, who it is, or anything like that. And until we can get the military benefit out of it, which we have to have since we have captured it, I don't think they'll go public. And also, it'll open a can of worms. There are so many things that our government, I'll be honest, they've lied to us about over the years. At lectures, I usually tell young people that anyone up to the age of 35 or 40 doesn't understand cover-up. Because they're growing up with it. Iran-Contra, Vietnam, Watergate, yes. Kennedy assassination. I mean, it's a whole list of nearly everything our government does today is in a cover-up form. So young people don't understand that. They're growing up with it and have accepted it. But 50 years ago, these guys that were involved in this were a special breed and trusted and respected the government.
And you know, it sounds, almost naive to think that somebody would be quiet because of patriotism. But back in those days, especially.
Oh, yeah. That we just came out of the Second World War. We had a lot of pride in our military, in our pride in our government, in our leaders. I'd lecture as many times, I'll say, name five people in the government you respect. And I get a blank look back.
Mm-hmm.
That's unfortunate. I'm not doing it to be amusing. It's just something that really gets your attention when you stop and think about it. Most people can't name five people that they respect.
There's another thing. I haven't mentioned this to you in many conversations, but there's the corporate side of this equation, too. There's money to be made out of these things that they back engineer and find, and so that may be reasons why they keep things covered up.
A lot of people ask, why don't they make contact with us? If, you know, if they're here or have been here, why don't they contact us? My immediate response is, why would they want to? I don't know what we have to offer. We're the only species on the planet that can't get along with each other and destroying the planet as fast as we can. So maybe they're watching to see us self-destruct. I don't know. But I think it would have a tremendous impact on the financial world, on religions of the world. No one country wants to give up their dedication to something from another planet. We need to start thinking of ourselves as humans rather than as nations, and as, I don't want to go with the one world phrase, but we've become so small, our planet has become so small, and communication is so technologically advanced.
Provincialism or nationalism is outdated. We just haven't figured that out. Dennis Balthizer, always great to have you here on the UFO Files, and always in person, it's wonderful. We are in Roswell, and Dennis, let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now.
Well, you know my webmaster, Faye, and
She's quite a delight and very talented.
She's amazing. She really is. She's an artist, and I write some text, and she puts some pictures on it or some artwork, and from there we have a good sight. But her and her husband had the idea of trying to syndicate some radio shows for me, and we have been working on three CDs where we're doing 3-minute shows and putting a month's worth of shows on a CD and sending packages out to radio stations all over the country, hoping they'll accept it and start using it. And what they are is a quick 3-minute question and answer session about my research.
Well, that's good, because Ronald Reagan started that way, you know. That's how he got...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. When he decided to get in politics, he started sending out the 3-minute shows. Radio stations started carrying them, and the next thing you know, he's making plenty of money off of the show.
That's not a bad example.
Yeah, right. So, there's room in radio for that. It's just a matter of getting people to buy.
We're finding that the program directors have such a tight schedule on radio program that it's hard to slip something else in unless they have a need for it.
Yeah, and the need for it is somebody buying some time.
Right. we're hopeful that we can get some play out of it.
Yeah.
I think my biggest thrill, Jerry, is not... It's doing interviews such as this one. It's doing lectures. This weekend I was at the Civic Center all weekend selling my tapes, and the biggest kick I got was the people that would come up and talk to me. Because as a serious researcher, I can talk to them about things that I'm aware of, and answer questions for them that maybe they haven't had answered before. And I think the questions and answers after lectures are my biggest challenge that I love the most, because you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you do this very long at a time, you realize that you don't dismiss anybody.
I judge my research by radio shows and the response we get from that, and then the lectures, the questions and answers. And the editorials, I get a lot of responses on editorials. I'll have people call me from or email me from all over the world, and sometimes don't know how they read them or where they found them, but I'll get some good positive feedback. Pleasure to be on your show, Jerry. You do a good job, and I appreciate you having me on, letting me share my research with your audience, and I wish you good luck with it.
Well, when you get that little camping trip up there to Dulce underway under the guise of being a hunter, let me know.
I think I'm going to go to Oklahoma and go fishing first.
Okay, that's a good place to go fishing. And with that, we're going to close it out. Dennis Balthizer, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening, folks, to the UFO File.
As we do this show, we just passed Income Tax Day. And in addition to that, we have a couple of birthdays that are pretty important. My daughter, Lori, have one. And Chrissy Blaze, probably the best astrologer in the business, also had a birthday. And Chrissy has a new website out, by the way. And basically, it's about astrology. You got to check it out sometime. Let me give you the address here. It's basically... called Global Astrology Online, and you probably need to write this down, SATIANNA.com. Just put that in a search engine, or put Chrissy Blaze in a search engine, it'll come up. She's one of our favorite people. She lives up in Michigan now, lived in Hollywood for a long time, born in England. We've done a lot of shows with her. Check out her shows on our website at jerrypippin.com. That's J-E-R-R-Y-P-I-P-P-I-N, all one word. P is a poem. jerrypippin.com.
Exopolitics Radio with Alfred Weber are the views of Alfred Weber and not specifically those of our on-air affiliates or our sponsors.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio, a weekly magazine format public affairs program on exopolitics, the new political science of outer space, the science of relations between our human civilization and other intelligent civilizations in the universe. Exopolitics Radio is produced by Phoenix Productions of Phoenix, Arizona, and can be heard worldwide on the internet at exopoliticsradio.com. Our audio archives, which remain free and open as a service to the public 24/7, are at exopoliticsradio.com. Exopolitics Radio is a listener-sponsored station, and we appreciate and depend upon the donations of our listeners to cover our necessary expenses. So please go to the donate button at the side of the website at exopoliticsradio.com and make a donation of whatever you can and whatever you wish. And this applies if you're listening to us at the website exopoliticsradio.com, if you're listening to us on our on-air affiliates at
WPRN
105.8
in New Orleans. That's one of them.
If you're listening
one
to us at Paranormal Radio Network.
Have special broadcasts. And this one's coming up, so this is a good time to go ahead and join. Some of you